This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego. I'm Diana Cutlow, the program officer for the Joan B. Kroc Distinguished Lecture Series, and I'm very pleased tonight to be standing in for our executive director, Joyce New, who's in Washington on sabbatical at the U.S. Institutes for Peace, and also for D'Acre, our interim director, who's on a brief trip to Nepal, working with the constituencies for peace there, working hopefully towards a peaceful election. Tonight is the last of the three Distinguished Lecture Series events this year, and we've been very thankful to have all international speakers this year as part of the university's drive towards internationalization and producing globally competent students. We feel it's very important to bring an international perspective to the issues that are facing us in today's world. We had Nobel Peace Laureate Shirin Ebadi in the fall for a lecture at Jenny Craig Pavilion with 1,800 people, including most of the students at the university through the provost's encouragement. We had a wonderful panel with experts from Asia and Africa on gender-inclusive peace building right before the Women Peacemakers Conference in the fall. And then tonight, our speaker is visiting us from Australia, but he is certainly a global citizen. These distinguished speakers help us to see the world in ways that we may not if we were only looking at it through our own eyes or through the U.S. media. And hopefully, they get us to push ourselves to make the changes in the world that we want to see. In an email exchange with our speaker about the title for tonight's lecture, I asked about using the word genocide instead of mass atrocities. And he told me that he felt that the word genocide had become very narrowly defined in legal terms, and that he really wanted to look more broadly at the kinds of mass atrocities that are happening all over the world that may not fit that definition. His thoughts have stayed with me as I think about how even low-level conflicts can stoke the cycles of violence that lead to mass atrocities, which usually leave civilians, especially women and children, as their victims. And I'm sure his comments tonight will encourage me to think more about other issues, and hopefully you as well, but more importantly, to act on them in our everyday lives. Now I'm pleased to welcome Julie Sullivan, Provost and Vice President of the University, to introduce tonight's speaker. Thank you.
Good evening. It is my pleasure to welcome you to the University of San Diego and also to introduce our distinguished speaker this evening. Gareth Evans, since January 2000, has been the president of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group. The International Crisis Group is an independent, nonprofit NGO with some 130 staff members located on five continents. They work worldwide through field-based analysis and high-level advocacy to prevent and resolve deadly conflict. Gareth, before he became the leader of the International Crisis Group in 2000, had a very auspicious over two-decade career in Australian politics. Most of us know his name as the Foreign Minister of Australia. During his time there, he had several accomplishments, but several that we would probably be most familiar with are his work with the UN Peace Plan for Cambodia, his significant work on the Chemical Weapons Convention, and the new Asia-Pacific Regional Economic and Security Architecture. In addition to being a politician and a world leader in areas such as conflict resolution, Gareth has maintained a very active academic and scholarly background. He is the author of numerous books, chapters, and journal articles in the areas of foreign relations, human rights, and legal and constitutional reform. He maintains connections with several academic institutions and journals. At Yale University, he is a member of the International Advisory Board of UN Studies. At Stanford University, he's a member of the Advisory Council of the Institute for International Studies. This has given me some ideas, by the way, Gareth. And he serves on the Editorial Advisory Board of the Cambridge Review of International Affairs. Gareth also is a very valued leader and input and advisor to significant policymakers. He is a member of the UN Secretary General's Advisory Committee on Genocide Prevention. These are numerous, but I have this very impressive. He's chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Governance Initiative Peace and Security Expert Group. He's fellow of the Foreign Policy Association, member of the International Council of the Asia Society, and a member of the International Advisory Board of the Pew Global Attitude Survey. Clearly, his wisdom and experience has been significant and valuable to people all around the world, and it's really our honor to welcome him to the University of San Diego this evening. Please join me in welcoming him.
Well, thanks very much, Julie, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for that very generous introduction. These days I feel I need all the introduction I can get around the place. But it is really an enormous pleasure and a privilege for me to have been invited to participate in this lecture series, not least since I find myself following in the footsteps of people of such extraordinary caliber and global reputation as Richard Goldstone and Mary Robinson and Hanan Ashrawi and Lloyd Axworthy and, most recently, Shirin Ebadi. After just a few short years of existence, the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice really is now on the map, not only for its fantastic building and facilities, which are really better than I've seen just about anywhere else in the world, but as a centre of excellence for policy-oriented debate, dialogue, teaching, outreach, and practical policy action in the cause of global peace. And that's a tribute, I think, to the quality of this institute's staff who run these outstanding programs so well and who, particularly Dana Cutlow, who you heard from at the beginning, and Erica Lopez, have looked after me so admirably during my short visit here. It's a tribute also, I think, to the breadth of vision of the University of San Diego administration, which is understood very clearly in a way that many others have not, just how an institute like this and a school of peace studies of the kind that's now being built here can really add luster to a university's national and international reputation and stature. And above all, it's a tribute to Joan Kroc herself, whose extraordinary generosity has made this whole thing possible. It's one of my abiding sorrows, actually, that I didn't meet Joan Kroc before she died 4 years ago. And that's not just because someone prepared to spend during her lifetime and beyond something like $100 million on supporting peace programs is the kind of person presidents of organizations like mine dream about getting to know. It's because she was obviously such a wonderful, larger-than-life character. Your founding director, Joyce New, told me in a message the other day that had St. Joan, as she described it, still been with us, she would have been sitting here somewhere in the front row, a model of panache and elegance, maybe not able to follow the lecture itself very closely because she became rather hard of hearing in her last years, but every now and again winking broadly at the speaker. Now, I have to say that of all the distractions that I've weathered on stages over the years, I think that would probably have been among the most disconcerting. Knowing that to do the polite thing and to wink right back, as I certainly would have been minded to do, would have left the rest of the audience thinking I'd lost my marbles. Anyway, the topic about which I've been asked to talk to you this evening is one on which I sometimes think we've all lost our marbles, or at least what might or might not be the same thing, our sense of common humanity and collective morality. Never again, we said, after the Holocaust, and then after the Cambodian genocide in the 1970s, and then again after the Rwandan genocide in 1994, and then just a year later after the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia. And now we're asking ourselves, yet again, in the face of more mass killing and dying in Darfur, whether we really are ever going to be able, as an international community, to stop nation states murdering their own people or allowing them to be murdered by others within their borders. Since 2003, in this region of the Sudan, more than 200,000 people have died from outright violence or war-related disease and malnutrition. Well over 2 million have been displaced. Peacekeeping efforts have been manifestly inadequate. Peace negotiations have gone nowhere. Humanitarian relief is faltering. The conflict is spilling over into neighbouring territories, countries, and the overall situation remains, frankly, very desolate. So how many more times will we look back wondering, with varying degrees of incomprehension and horror and anger and shame, how could we have let all this happen? The truth of the matter is that it's taken the world an insanely long time to come to terms with the idea, even, that there's something fundamentally and intolerably wrong about states killing or forcibly displacing large numbers of their own citizens, or standing by when others do so. For centuries, going all the way back to the emergence of the modern system of sovereign states in the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, for all these years, the view has prevailed that, to put it bluntly, sovereignty, the possession by a country of the recognised trappings of independent statehood, that sovereignty is a licence to kill. That what happens within state borders, however grotesque, however morally indefensible, is just nobody else's business. In the history of ideas, there's been some very bad ones indeed, but few of them more destructive over so many centuries as this one. One would have thought that Hitler's Holocaust would have put paid to that notion once and for all. And certainly, some major gains were made. Individual and group human rights were recognised in the UN Charter, and more grandly and more explicitly, excuse me, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And with the drafting of the Charter of the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1945, there did come the recognition in international law of the concept of crimes against humanity, which could be committed by a government against its own people and not necessarily just during wartime. But running alongside all this was a continued, very clear recognition of the traditional view of state sovereignty. The language of the 1945 UN Charter says in Article 2.7 that nothing should authorise intervention in matters essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state. The UN founders were really overwhelmingly preoccupied with the problem of states waging war against each other, and they certainly took unprecedented steps to limit the freedom of action of states in that respect. But notwithstanding all the genocidal horrors that were inflicted during the Second World War, they really did show no particular interest in the question of what constraints might be imposed on how states dealt with their own subjects. The state of mind that even massive atrocity crimes like those of the Cambodian killing fields were not the rest of the world's business prevailed throughout the UN's first half century of existence. Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia, which stopped the Khmer Rouge in its tracks, was universally attacked, not applauded. The traditional view of sovereignty, again, as enabling absolute control of everything internal and demanding immunity from external intervention, was also, I have to say, much reinforced during this period by the large increases in UN membership during the decolonisation era. The states who joined the UN during this period were all newly proud of their identity, conscious in many cases of their fragility, and generally saw the non-intervention norm as being one of their few defences against threats and pressures from more powerful international actors seeking to promote their own economic and political interests. Not even the signing of the Genocide Convention of 1948 made very much difference to all of this, despite its apparently quite explicit override of the non-intervention principle for at least this most extreme of all crimes against humanity. The coining of the word genocide by the legal scholar Raphael Lemkin in 1944, yoking together the Greek noun for family, tribe or race and the Latin verb for massacre, was itself, of course, a very important development in the history of ideas, capturing some of the momentous quality of actions that are aimed not just at destroying individuals, but whole national, racial, ethnic or religious groups. But it was almost as if, with the signing of the Genocide Convention, the task of actually addressing man-made atrocities was seen as complete. It took the major powers years, in the case of the United States, I have to say 40 years, to actually ratify the Genocide Convention. It was rarely invoked after it was ratified and has never been effectively applied, either to prevent or punish actual atrocities. The US government's willingness to embrace the G word in the case of Darfur did not make a sense worth of difference when it came to actually taking more robust action in response. And the very long-awaited test case in the International Court of Justice, Bosnia against Serbia, which was decided very recently, held, in fact, that Serbia had not committed genocide in Srebrenica, although it did have some culpability as a state for failing to prevent it. And this showed all too clearly, as Diana mentioned before, and as lawyers have long feared, that the legal definition of genocide in the convention, requiring in particular very particular kinds of intent to be proved toward a very particular kind of group, is just so narrow in scope that there are very few kinds of behaviour by either individuals or governments that will be caught by it. With the arrival of the 1990s and the end of the Cold War, the prevailing complacent assumptions about non-intervention did at last come under some challenge, as never before. The quintessential peace and security problem, as most of us can remember, became not interstate war, war between states, but rather civil war and internal violence perpetrated on a massive scale. With the breakup of various Cold War state structures, most obviously in Yugoslavia, and with the removal of some superpower constraints, conscience-shocking situations repeatedly arose. But still, old habits of non-intervention died very hard, even when situations cried out for some kind of response. Even when the international community did react through the UN, it was too often erratically, incompletely, or counterproductively, as in the debacle of Somalia in 93, the catastrophe of Rwanda in 94, and the almost unbelievable default in Srebrenica just a year later. Then came Kosovo in 1999, when the international community did in fact intervene, as it probably, certainly, I think, should have. But it did so without the authority of the Security Council, because there was a threatened veto by Russia. And the fact that the international community reacted this way without such authority, of course, raised very anxious questions about the integrity of the whole international security system, even when the right thing on the face of it was being done. In response to these various emerging situations, one powerful new idea did emerge during the 1990s and, in fact, dominated international discourse during that period. And this was the concept coined by the founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, Bernard Kouchner, a droit d'ingérence, the right to intervene, or more fully, the right of humanitarian intervention. But the trouble with this language is that while it was from many perspectives a noble and a very effective rallying cry, around the world it enraged about as many as it inspired. Throughout the decade, arguments about the right to intervene, mostly from the global north, were met by equally vehement claims, mostly from the global south, about the primacy and the continued resonance of the concept of national sovereignty. So battle lines were drawn and trenches were dug and verbal missiles flew. The debate was intense, it was very bitter, and the 90s finished with it utterly unresolved in the UN or anywhere else. Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, at one stage made his own effort to resolve the conceptual impasse which was at the heart of this debate by arguing that national sovereignty had to be weighed and balanced in these cases against individual sovereignty, as recognised, as he put it, in the international human rights instruments. But this approach again really fell on deaf ears, being seen, I think accurately, it's not so much resolving the dilemma of intervention, but simply restating it in different words. In his report then to the General Assembly in 2000, the Secretary-General brought the issue finally to a very public head, saying in language that was both very moving and very agitated, and which does resonate, I think, to this day, "If humanitarian intervention," he said, "is indeed an unacceptable assault on sovereignty, how should we respond to a Rwanda, to a Srebrenica, to gross and systematic violations of human rights?" Well, that was the question. The task of meeting the challenge posed by Kofi Annan fell, in the event, to the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, which was sponsored by the Canadian government, and more particularly its very far-sighted then Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy, one of my predecessors in this distinguished lecture series. I had the privilege of co-chairing that commission, along with the Algerian diplomat and veteran UN Africa advisor Mohamed Sanoun, and we had a really quite superb team to work with, including as the US representative, none other than Lee Hamilton, without whom, of course, no panel these days of the great and good would ever be complete. We presented our report, called The Responsibility to Protect, at the end of 2001. The objectives of that commission, as we defined them to ourselves from the outset, were really threefold. To produce a guide to action or responses by the international community to internal man-made human rights violating catastrophes, which would be intellectually credible and satisfying, not profoundly offending either the lawyers or the philosophers, well represented, I see here this evening. Secondly, which would be politically credible enough not to be rejected out of hand as a framework for action by either North or South, by the permanent five members of the Security Council or by any other international constituency. And thirdly, compelling enough in its basic message to be able in practice to actually motivate action and mobilise support when a situation demanding such a response arose. In the event, I think we made, it's fair to say, four main contributions to the international policy debate, which have been, again, resonating ever since. The first, and perhaps ultimately politically the most useful, was to invent a whole new way of talking about humanitarian intervention. We sought to turn the whole weary debate about the right to intervene on its head and to recharacterise the issue not as an argument about the right of states to do anything, but rather about their responsibility. One, to protect people at grave risk. And the relevant perspective, we argued, was not that of prospective interveners, the big guys wanting to throw their weight around, but rather those needing support. The searchlight was swung back where it always should be, on the need to protect communities from mass killing and ethnic cleansing, to protect women from systematic rape, children from starvation. The Commission's hope was, and so far broadly our experience has been, that using responsibility to protect rather than right to intervene language would in fact enable entrenched opponents to find new ground on which to constructively engage. We very much had in mind, as I was talking to some of your students today to this effect, the power of new ideas, or of old ideas at least newly expressed, to actually change the behaviour of key policy actors. And the model that we had very much in mind in this respect was the Brundtland Commission, which you'll recall a few years earlier had introduced the concept of sustainable development to bridge the huge gap which then existed between developers and environmentalists. The point is that with a new script, the actors have to change their lines. They really do have to think afresh about what the real issues in the play actually are. The second contribution of the Commission, which was linked with the first and again I think was conceptually significant, was to insist upon a new way of talking about sovereignty. We argued, building on an earlier formulation by Francis Deng, that the essence of sovereignty should now be seen not as control, as in the centuries-old Westphalian tradition, but again as responsibility. So the starting point was that every state has the primary responsibility to protect the individuals within it. But that's not the finishing point. Where the state fails in that responsibility, either through incapacity or through ill will, then a secondary responsibility to protect falls on the wider international community. And that, in a nutshell, is the core of the responsibility to protect idea, or, in this age of acronymphomania, R2P, as we are all now calling it for short. The third contribution of the Commission was to make it clear that responsibility to protect is about much more than just intervention, and in particular military intervention. It extends to a whole continuum of obligations, the responsibility to prevent these situations arising, most obvious, most important of all in an ideal world, but I have to say most consistently neglected in the real one. It extended then to the responsibility to react to situations when they did arise, with a whole graduated menu of responses, from the persuasive through to the coercive. And then finally, on that continuum, the responsibility to rebuild after any intrusive intervention had occurred, or any really major society-threatening catastrophe had occurred. The fourth and remaining contribution of the Commission was to come up with guidelines for when the most extreme form of coercive action, military action, would be appropriate. The first criterion, we argued, was obviously legality. Here we saw our task as being not so much to try to find alternatives to the clear legal authority of the Security Council, but rather to make the Security Council work better so that there was less chance of it being bypassed. So this was then followed by five criteria of legitimacy, designed as a set of benchmarks, which, while they might not guarantee consensus in any particular case, would hopefully make the achievement of that consensus more likely. Well, I must confess I didn't have this lecture at the University of San Diego in mind when we actually crafted those criteria. They would be very familiar indeed to an audience of Catholic intellectuals because they were unashamedly, if inexplicitly, based on just war principles. In short, the principles we specified were the seriousness of the harm being threatened, the motivation or primary purpose of the proposed military action, whether there were reasonably available peaceful alternatives, the proportionality of the response, and finally the balance of consequences, whether more good than harm would be done. Well, it's one thing to develop a concept like the responsibility to protect, but it's really quite another to get any policymaker to take any notice of it. The world is full of commission reports gathering dust on shelves around the world. I know because I've written a few of them which have gathered such dust. The most interesting thing, I think, about the Responsibility to Protect report is the way its central theme, as I've described it, has continued to gain traction internationally, even though it was almost suffocated, in fact, at birth by being published in December 2001 in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And by the massive international preoccupation with terrorism rather than internal human rights catastrophes, which then began. But in just five short years, which is really a quite remarkably brief time in the history of ideas, the responsibility to protect concept has evolved from a gleam in an international commission's eye, or I sometimes say in my more chauvinistic moments, a sort of an idea under my own shower. It's moved from that to what now has the pedigree to be described as a broadly accepted international norm, and one with the potential to evolve further into a fully-fledged rule of customary international law. Now, on any view, that's an encouraging story, and we ought to be encouraged by it. The concept was first seriously embraced in the doctrine of the newly emerging African Union. And over the next 2 to 3 years, it won quite a constituency also among academic commentators and international lawyers, which is a not unimportant constituency, given that international law is the rather odd beast that it is, capable of evolving through practice and commentary, as well as through formal treaty instruments. But the really big step forward came with the UN 60th Anniversary World Summit in September 2005, which followed a major preparatory effort involving the report of the high-level panel on new security threats in 2004, of which I was rather conveniently a member, which then fed in turn into a major report by the Secretary-General himself called Enlarger Freedom. Both these reports emphatically embraced the responsibility to protect concept, and the summit outcome document in 2005, which was unanimously agreed to by the more than 150 heads of state and government that were then there present and meeting as the UN General Assembly, unambiguously picked up the core recommendations. The language they embraced, although it was a little bit wordier and a little bit woollier than it needed to be, was really a quite clear-cut picking up of the core theme of the Commission report. As you'll see when I quote the key words, each individual state has the responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. We accept that responsibility and will act in accordance with it. The international community, through the United Nations, also has the responsibility to help protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. In this context, we are prepared to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council, in accordance with the Charter, including Chapter 7, which is about the use of force, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities are manifestly failing to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. That this endorsement occurred was really, looking back, anything but inevitable. Not much else of any significance was agreed to by the summit, despite all the preparatory build-up and all the high expectations. A fierce rearguard action was fought almost to the last by a small group of developing countries, joined rather cynically by Russia, who basically refused to concede any kind of limitation on the full and untrammelled exercise of state sovereignty, however irresponsible that exercise might be. What carried the day in the end was not so much consistent support from the EU and the US, support which I have to say after the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was not particularly helpful when it came to meeting those familiar sovereignty concerns. The support that mattered, rather, was persistent advocacy by sub-Saharan African countries, led by South Africa, and a clear and historically quite significant embrace of limited sovereignty principles by the Latin American countries, which will be well appreciated in this audience, how significant that was, and also some very effective last-minute personal diplomacy with major wavering country leaders by the Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin. Since the September 2005 summit, a further important conceptual development has occurred, the adoption by the Security Council in April last year of a thematic resolution on the protection of civilians in armed conflict, which contains, in an operative paragraph, an express reaffirmation of those World Summit conclusions relating to the responsibility to protect. And we've now actually seen that resolution in turn being invoked in subsequent specific situations, as with Resolution 1706 of August on Darfur. A General Assembly resolution can be quite helpful, as the World Summits unquestionably was, in identifying relevant principles, but the Security Council is really the institution that matters when it comes to executive action, and at least a toehold there has now been carved. Well, that's all pretty good news, but I'm afraid that's where the good news rather ends. We simply can't be confident that the world will respond quickly, effectively, and appropriately to new human rights catastrophes as they arise, as the current case of Darfur is all too unhappily demonstrating. The responsibility to protect has become a potentially powerful idea, but it will only be really powerful if it's implemented effectively in practice. And there's much unfinished business to attend to in this respect, falling from my perspective into four main categories, and I'll conclude with this description. The first problem is to hold the line against backsliding. We can't unfortunately assume that the bridgehead that was achieved at the World Summit and in subsequent Security Council resolutions will necessarily hold. Some member states, particularly in Asia, were very reluctant indeed to accept this part of the summit outcome document, and they do continue to fight a rearguard action against it. The phenomenon of buyer's remorse is very evident. They've been much aided in this respect, I have to say again, by R2P's responsibility protects false friends. Occasional efforts by defenders of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, notably the UK government, to paint it as justified by R2P principles, as other defences, of course, in terms of the possession of weapons of mass destruction or support for international terrorism, crumbled away, have not been, those attempts, at all analytically persuasive. But what they have done is succeed admirably in reinforcing the arguments of R2P opponents that any concession at all as to the limits of state sovereignty would create an excuse that would be exploited all too willingly by neo-colonialists and neo-imperialists keen to revert to their bad old interventionist habits of decades past. One sign of possible difficulties ahead was the rejection by the Security Council in January this year, just 3 months ago, with vetoes from China and Russia, actually cast together for the first time since 1972, and with South Africa voting against, vetoes and voting against a resolution condemning Burma or Myanmar's appalling human rights record. The argument of the opponents was that the government's behaviour was not a threat to international peace and thus outside the Security Council's jurisdiction. Well, while it's certainly arguable that Myanmar's human rights violations, while deplorable, have not been of the same character or scale of those in Darfur or Kosovo or Srebrenica or Rwanda, and as such don't squarely raise R2P principles, while that's certainly arguable, nonetheless, it's very disturbing, nonetheless, to see prevailing in this way a quite narrow view of the scope of the Security Council's authority under the UN Charter and the parallel return to favour of a broader view of the protection from international scrutiny and censure which is conferred by state sovereignty. As the retired Archbishop of Cape Town, Desmond Tutu, put it, if others are using the arguments we're using today, when we ask them for their support against apartheid, we might still have been unfree. And those of us who are concerned to consolidate responsibility to protect as a universally accepted international norm, and one legitimising very close attention by the Security Council toward the behaviour to their own people of a number of deeply unsavoury regimes, we'll have to stay on our toes for a good while longer yet. The second bit of unfinished business is to adopt guidelines for the use of military force. The Canadian Commission recognised that the issue of when it's actually right to fight, to use, in other words, the most extreme of the options available to react to an R2P situation, it recognised that had to be specifically addressed if the idealism of our concept of international responsibility was to be realistically applicable in practice. So we accordingly identified, as I've already mentioned, a set of prudential criteria in this respect, which we argued should be adopted by the Security Council. These were, again, I remind you, the seriousness of the harm being threatened, which we argued would need to involve a large-scale loss of life or ethnic cleansing to prima facie justify something as extreme as military action. Secondly, the motivation or primary purpose of the proposed military action, namely whether it was primarily to halt or avert the threat in question or had some other less exalted objective. Thirdly, whether there were reasonably available peaceful alternatives. Fourthly, the proportionality of the response, which speaks for itself. And finally, not least, the balance of consequences, whether overall more harm than good or more good than harm would be done by military invasion. These recommendations were subsequently embraced in the run-up to the World Summit by the high-level panel that I referred to and by the Secretary-General's report, which I've also referred to, but they were not actually adopted by the World Summit, and they remain, as a result, in limbo. They were rejected, those criteria, by the US in particular, because it didn't want any restraints on its unrestricted freedom of action in these situations. And it was rejected by the G77, the developing countries, on the rather less understandable ground that to articulate these criteria was somehow nonetheless to encourage the great powers to misuse them and to apply military force notwithstanding. Be that as it may, for whatever reason, they were not endorsed. Of course, no criteria of the kind that we argued for, even if they were actually agreed as guidelines by the Security Council, will ever end argument as to how they should be applied in particular instances. For example, Darfur right now, where in fact my own organisation, the International Crisis Group, has taken the view that when it comes to coercive military intervention, at least right now, the balance of consequences test actually argues against any such attempted invasion. And the real four reasons that it would very disastrously impact on the humanitarian relief effort, which is keeping some 2 million people alive, and also that would probably lead to a total breakdown of the North-South peace agreement, which is hanging by a thread at the moment. We've argued that coercive military invasion-type response, even if it could be put together, would be inappropriate for that reason, and that right now the balance, right now the real need is for coercive economic pressure to be applied, which we think would in fact, if it was properly applied and very enthusiastically applied, particularly by the US, would make a difference. But there can be arguments of this kind going backwards and forwards. The short point for present purposes is I think it's very hard to believe that it would not be more helpful than the present totally ad hoc system to actually have such criteria, to focus attention in this way on all the relevant issues, revealing weaknesses in argument and generally encouraging consensus as a result. So that's a bit of unfinished business, an important bit of unfinished business, to try and get those guidelines adopted. The third bit of unfinished business is to build available capacity. If R2P is not to remain more theoretical than real, we have to somehow resolve the problem of capacity, ensuring that the right civilian and, as necessary, military resources are always there in the right amounts and with the appropriate capability. And that means having readily available a set of responses that are somewhere between, as Lee Feinstein has recently put it in a Council of Foreign Relations paper, somewhere between the stark options of doing nothing on the one hand and sending in the Marines on the other. So what we need is really stronger early warning, coordination and response machinery at the centre. We need the UN Secretary General to have a person of real international stature working full-time and with appropriate reports, with appropriate support staff, reporting to him as a special advisor on the prevention of genocide and other mass atrocities, something the SG is considering right now as we speak. We do need effective diplomatic capacity, ready and available and properly resourced, to negotiate and mediate those situations which are capable, at least, of being stopped by effective early intervention of that kind. We need a repertoire of carefully thought-through sanctions measures with an effective, professionally resourced mechanism ready to be put in place immediately to monitor the application and effectiveness of those sanctions, something which just doesn't exist at the moment. We need a full range of civilian capabilities, especially effective policing, on permanent standby with the capacity to be immediately deployed. And we do also need effective preparedness to mount military operations for civilian protection purposes, with, if at all possible, the consent of the government in question, as with the case in East Timor, for example, and has been the case with the limited forces so far sent to Darfur, but also, in really extreme cases, if there's no other way of protecting the people in question from slaughter and ethnic cleansing without that consent. The experience of the current AU mission in Darfur is a classic demonstration of the problem of military capacity. Even in a consensual situation. Too few troops, too poorly equipped, too immobile to perform effectively even the limited civilian protection task that's required by their present mandate. The UN is currently feeling desperately overstretched, with over 80,000 military and 15,000 civilian personnel deployed worldwide. But when you think about it, with the world's armed services currently absorbing some 20 million men and women in uniform, with another 50 million reservists and another 11 million paramilitaries, it hardly seems beyond the wit of humankind to work out a way of making some of that capacity available when and where it's needed to prevent and react to man-made catastrophe. Another crucial practical operational issue involving the military is to address the question, up until now almost completely neglected by the world's militaries, of developing detailed concepts of these R2P civilian protection operations, which involve, again when you think about it, neither traditional war fighting, where the object is not to stop violence as such, but rather to defeat an enemy, and on the other hand, peacekeeping operations, which although these days usually involving much more than the traditional passive monitoring, have still not come to grips with the kind of responses that are really needed to cope with the threat or the reality of atrocity crimes. It's not just a matter of force configuration, having more rapidly deployable units and not people standing beside tanks in Germany waiting for the Russians to come, but really it's a matter of developing new doctrine and new kinds of rules of engagement, new kinds of training. We know what has to be done, but none of this has been done. And then finally, as always, there's the question, when you talk about unfinished business, of generating the political will to act. As always, this is the biggest and hardest piece of business to achieve. But we have to recognise that finding the necessary political will to do anything hard, or anything expensive, or anything politically sensitive, or anything not directly seen, for better or worse, as relevant to national interests, is just a given in international affairs, in public affairs, whether you're talking domestically or internationally. Its absence should not be a matter for lamentation, but for mobilisation. Political will isn't hiding in a cupboard or under a stone somewhere waiting to be discovered. Political will always has to be painstakingly built. And I think all of us have a role in this respect. Not only those occupying the commanding heights of policy making and decision making, but academics and students and NGOs and ordinary members of the community of the kind that are gathered here this evening. It's a matter of not just top-down effort with key officials and key governments and those who can influence them directly, as hopefully we can in the crisis group, making the effort to persuade and to mobilise their peers in the international community to take the necessary action in the UN Security Council and elsewhere. It's also a matter of bottom-up mobilisation, making the voices of ordinary concerned citizens heard in the corridors of power. At any level, whether you're talking about sort of up there or down there, the key to mobilising the necessary political will from all the necessary political actors, policy actors, and a very large cast of them, both in the national government and intergovernmental levels, the key is partly, of course, to have good organisation and good lobbying techniques and good contacts. But above all, I really believe it's also to have good arguments, intelligently and energetically advanced. Those arguments can be of a number of different kinds. They can be party interest arguments designed to consolidate a government's vocal domestic base. Always, let's face it, an important element in the Bush administration's interest in Sudan, such as it's been. There can be national interest arguments, and they're in fact much easier to make these days in relation to what Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, famously dismissed in the 1930s as quarrels in faraway countries between people of whom we know nothing. Easier to make because of what we do know now about the capacity of failed states in this globalised world to be a source of havoc for everyone else. And there's financial arguments in terms of, in short, $1 million worth of preventive action, saving very often $1 billion worth of later military intervention expense. And then even when all else fails, there are, in fact, usefully deployable moral arguments, given that however base politicians' real motives may be, and I speak from 21 years of experience in this respect, they do really rather like always to be seen as acting from higher motives. So it's important to give them the arguments to do just that. We can, if we need to, we can always justify making responsibility to protect a reality on hard-headed, practical national interest grounds, on the basis that, as I really just indicated, states that can't or won't stop internal atrocity crimes are really the kind of rogue states or failed states or failing states that can't or won't stop terrorism or weapons proliferation or drug and people trafficking or the spread of health pandemics or other global risks. But all that said, at the end of the day, the case for the responsibility to protect rests simply on our common humanity. The impossibility of ignoring the cries of pain and distress of our fellow human beings. For any of us in and around the international community, whether we're individuals or NGOs or national governments or international organisations, for any of us to yet again ignore that distress and agony, to once again make never again a cry that rings totally emptily, is really to diminish that common humanity to the point of despair. We should be united in our determination to not let that happen, and I think there's no greater or nobler cause on which any of us could be embarked. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gareth. I'm actually going to start with a question that came through cyberspace via Joyce New. You know it's killing her not to be here tonight. And one of the things that she was wondering about is that we all realize the benefits of focusing on particular crises, of bringing attention to different conflicts. But are there dangers as well that by doing that publicly, we in fact are pushing people to try to consolidate their positions in a way that may cause more violence in those areas?
Absolutely not. There's never enough attention that you can give to these situations, never enough spotlight of publicity you can put on the ugliness of what's occurring. The really horrible actions of really horrible people flourish best in dark corners and dark spaces and away from that spotlight. The horrors of Rwanda were really only able to be perpetrated because they were given insufficient attention, insufficient publicity, far too readily dismissed as just another episode in the endless repertoire of conflict between tribal actors in darkest Africa. The only way to begin to deal sensibly and effectively with these issues is to bring them into the spotlight of public discourse and international discourse. It's true that sometimes when it comes to solving these problems and finding solutions to some of these conflicts and the atrocity perpetration that's going on, you do need to use back channels to operate outside the framework of that publicity and in a way that might be seen as involving some abdication of responsibility to tell truth to power or to some abdication of responsibility to keep an issue in the spotlight. True it is that sometimes that's what diplomatic mediation negotiation is all about. Sometimes you have to negotiate some rather unpalatable things like possibly giving amnesty to people sitting across the table from you who you would prefer to have strung up by piano wire. But the truth of the matter is, for all those sort of tactical and strategic considerations, the worst thing that can happen when one is in the business of conflict prevention and mass atrocity prevention, the worst possible thing that can happen is for just nobody to really know what's going on, nobody to notice what's going on, and for that horror to sort of flourish without any attention at all. There's some downside risks, yes, at the margin in some of these cases on giving it attention when you're trying to negotiate an outcome, but by and large, overwhelmingly, the balance is on the side of really close and immense attention.
Now, kind of in light of that answer, you had many choices when you left politics. You could have gone into business, you could have gone to work for the international organizations at the UN directly, but you chose to work through an NGO, and we're curious about why an NGO was the spot that you felt that you could be most effective.
Well, I wasn't sure that was going to be very effective at all, but it just sounded like a pretty good change of pace and direction from 21 years of relentless exposure and media up every nostril, cameras and microphones, and just a sense that I wanted to take stock. And the NGO that I went to at that stage was really was a change of pace, because it didn't have, as it has now, 130 people working in 60 countries and with a budget of 15 million. We had 20 people working in about three countries with a budget of less than 2 million and stuck away in a funny little sort of maison de ville in the back streets of Brussels. So it wasn't that I thought that I was going to change the world in a different way. I wasn't quite sure I was going to be able to change anything. But it really is interesting. The freedom of action that NGO involvement gives you is very different, of course, from the kind of constraints that are upon you as a government. You really can speak out, speak your mind on all sorts of issues, whether anyone takes any notice or something else, but you do have that freedom. What's lacking, of course, and where I do notice the contrast is the lack of any actual executive authority. You're not actually sitting in the rooms where decisions are made. All you can hope to do is influence those who are. And to that extent, you are always going to be a bit of a bit player. But there is a really very significant and increasing role to be played by these bit players these days. And it really is quite extraordinary the way in which the non-government community has burgeoned and grown so rapidly and has become such a significant source of information, analysis and ideas for policymakers. As I was telling, I think, the student group today, one of the things that stuck in my mind rather vividly was a conversation I had with Kofi Annan just a couple of years ago, when he said, look, when I read your reports, and interestingly he did read our reports, I know that what I'm very often hearing is the voice of my own UN people on the ground that I'm not hearing coming up through the system in the UN itself, with all the self-censorship and all the pressures and all the constraints and all the backside protection from the higher-ups, all the anxiety not to offend member states that comes with the territory in a lot of those institutional environments. He said, I know, because of your independence and because you've got access to all these people, you're recording what they're really thinking about these situations. And I'm getting and hearing the unvarnished sort of truth, more or less. And that was encouraging. And what I also hear from many governments, and it's extraordinary how many governments support an organisation like mine, about 24 of them at last count, with really quite large sums of money. And they do so because what is lacking these days from so many governments, even great and powerful countries like the United States that have no particular resource constraints on putting people in these situations, what's lacking is a capacity of diplomats to do their traditional jobs. They're all locked up behind high stone walls and barbed wire and with all sorts of constraints about who they can talk to. And so it's very difficult to get a sense of the pulse of what's going on in these situations, who the real actors are, what the real dynamics are. So organisations like mine and like other NGOs that are working on the ground, in this context, become really quite significant sources of information analysis, as I say, and in a way that really does make you feel that at least you're contributing something of relevance to the wider situation.
Well, thank you. That's something the International Crisis Group does very well.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.